of Babylon, I thought it was appropriate. We are the afflicted. We are the fallen and the wounded. We are born into separateness, suffering, and eternal longing. Our salvation lies not in the things of this world, but that is where we seek it. Oh, rats. Where'd it go? I don't know what happened. It just disappeared. Oh, there it is. Our salvation lies not in the things of this world, but that is where we seek it. For to do otherwise would tank the economy, and then we'd all be screwed. That's the average American mentality. As espoused by Chuck Lorre, the fine producer and creator of many of our funny shows. So at the end of it all, it's about the economy, though. And that's what people have to recognize is the problem, one of the problems with this nation. All right, well, if that didn't get you out of fellowship, or if it did, now's the time to rebound, and let's continue on here. Dealing with this, we're down to point 14 here, dealing with verses 4 and 5. I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, that you may not participate in her sins, and that you may not receive of her plagues. For her sins have piled up as high as heaven, and God has remembered her crimes." Iniquities, I was going to say, that was the way the New American Standard translated it, was iniquities. Crimes is probably better there. So that gives the spiritual aspect of it in terms of the way they treat other people. Well, 14 here is where we left off. While the geographic will, well, again, 13, the challenge should be obvious. Those that have made the salvation adjustment will be commanded to exit what appears to be the most powerful, affluent economic nation at that time. And again, it doesn't appear to be, it actually is. And if people won't make the adjustments now when it's easy, what makes you think they're going to make them when it's harder? Well, you have the opportunity to orient now, and there's no pressure as far as in terms of you have to get out of the country or you're going to die. That's a lot of pressure. Now you can just orient to God's plan willingly and freely and straighten up certain things in your life. Well, while the geographic will of God may have included living in Babylon to that point, it has now irrevocably changed. The Jews are commanded to lead a modern-day exodus out of Babylon and return to Israel. And again, I think the primary emphasis of my people is on the Jews, but also it's broadened because of the fact that we know Gentiles become a part of this by faith. So 15, one should not underestimate the demanding nature of this task. While there is a period of grace, the tenor of the command suggests that they are urgent, that they are to be taken seriously and acted on with all speed and diligence. If I told you, you really only have an hour to live and if you stay here, you might be motivated to get out. Now, obviously, in our situation, traveling an hour wouldn't make any difference, given what we know the nature of this is going to be. But if people were told, again, the problem is going to be the same problem you face today, the same apathy from people who, I don't want to pay the price to do that. That takes too much time. I'm not interested in that. That's too hard. God's too demanding. Well, that day, he may be demanding, but if you don't get out, you're going to die. So God has a right to be demanding, as we might say. So the summons to separate from Babylon is to be obeyed immediately. Since the destruction of that entity is imminent, once the angels make their announcements. 17, the Old Testament passages in Jeremiah 50 and 51, as well as Isaiah 13, use language that cannot be applied to historic Babylon. In fact, the natural reading of Isaiah 13, 11 through 13, suggests that this judgment will have a worldwide impact. And in fact, when we get into Isaiah, which is going to be the next chapter we will do, is Isaiah 13 following this in Revelation. Once we've set the historic tone and demonstrated that Babylon has to be in the last days, that it has to be a prophetic entity and not an historic one, and then you get into this, you realize that the language here, what's happening is as you approach, and you're in Daniel's 70th week now, you've got 7 years, and the midpoint here at 3.5 technically begins the day of the Lord. And as you're approaching this, the judgments here are global. They extended completely around the globe. And this starts in a small way with Babylon, the microcosm of judgment. It's going to be a big judgment, don't get me wrong. It's going to destroy pretty much the Western Hemisphere. But that's nothing compared to destroying the whole world. And that's where this is all headed. And that's what, if you read in Isaiah here, Isaiah 13, it sets the time frame for us for this destruction. Verse 6. For the day of the Lord is near. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. Therefore, and this broadens it from just the destruction of Babylon, which is going to be huge. It's going to be earth-shaking, literally, going to shake the earth, apparently off its axis that it's on now, and is going to make some dramatic changes in the planet. The rotation speed of the earth is going to be speeded up by a third. I presume this comes for several causes. All of this is detailed in Revelation 8, where you find those trumpet judgments. I believe it's Revelation 8. And in the trumpet judgments, you get the fallout from the nuking of Babylon. And one of the fallouts is the earth speed is increased. And this is done most likely by the expulsion of the great amounts of material that are going to be blown off this planet. Massive amounts of land are going to be removed from this. And one of the things you should know about centrifugal force and all of that, when an object is spinning, one of the ways to increase its speed is to lighten it, to take some of the bulk off of it. And that certainly happens. Now, this could also increase the Earth's speed of rotation, depending upon how they hit in terms of where they hit. If they strike the Earth at an angle and it's already spinning in that direction and they hit it, it's likely going to increase that spin as well. So there's a number of factors that get into this. The physics of it is, well, we can't reproduce it because there's no way to reproduce what this is going to be. And the world is headed for this catastrophe. All hands will fall limp. And that goes beyond just the hands in Babylon. And every man's heart will melt. When you get into verse 11 here, it's clearly more universal. I will punish the world for its evil. And I will punish the wicked for their iniquity. And I will put an end to the arrogance of the proud. And I will abase the haughtiness of the ruthless. And I will make mortal man scarcer than pure gold. And mankind will be scarcer than the gold of Ophir. Therefore I will make the heavens tremble, and the earth will be shaken from its place. And it's not even a passive there in the Hebrew. It's an active. The earth will move from its place at the fury of the Lord of the armies. And so there's some indication, as people have considered this, in books like Earth's Earliest Age, and if you're familiar with Morris, Henry Morris has done a lot of work on creation, the world before the fall, the world after the fall, the world before the flood, the antediluvian world, and the world after the flood, the post-diluvian world. And certainly things changed dramatically with the flood. The first evidence of this is in the longevity of mankind. People were living 600, 700, 800, 900 years was not unusual. And then suddenly, within just a generation or two, the average lifespan dropped to 70. And it was still that when Moses wrote in 1445 BC. That's seen in Psalm 90. And by the way, a lifespan is not a generation. So, and those who want to make that play that semantic game don't understand the definition of words. That, to me, is ludicrous. If I live to be 90, that doesn't mean my whole generation did. We talk about a generation in terms of people born at a certain time. The baby boom generation, Gen X, all of this. Well, certainly multiple generations are on the planet at any given time. And if you make a generation a lifespan, well, then you've only got one generation ever. That means you can't count your children. That would be the next generation. But, you know, if a generation's your lifespan, they don't count. And so that is just a failure to understand the meaning of words. I don't understand how people cannot do that. That a lifespan is not a generation. So here he says, Morris has done a lot of this work, though. And the indication is that the earth at one time was, the entire planet was a tropical paradise. Much of what science says about the original earth is true from a biblical standpoint. There was at one time just one landmass, Pangaea, if that's what you want to call it. Doesn't make any difference to me what it calls. Pangaea, the reason they call it, it just means all land. Every land. It was just one. And so then the earth was divided. In the days of Peleg, the Bible talks about this. The earth was divided. In what way? Well, it was divided physically, for one thing. Certain forces that were acting upon the planet put into motion certain things, like continental drift. That's real. Don't think that they're making that up. It's real. And again, much of what science will tell you is correct. They just don't have the figures in place. And of course, they want an endless number of years for all this to happen. We've dated something. I saw yesterday. We found something that's at least 400,000 years old. No, it's not. It's absolutely not. And that's crazy. Man's only been on the earth, and that's pretty readily proven that man hadn't been on the earth but for about 6,000 years. And there's no evidence of any real life before that. But what we do have evidence of is that the earth at one time was all a tropical paradise or subtropical paradise. That apparently the earth was spinning more on an upright, on its axis and not at the 23.5 degrees or whatever we have now. And that affects the planet in terms of weather and all. So when that earth, and if the earth gets moved back up straight, we also seem to have a situation where this phrase time, and half a times is used. That's 1 year, 2 years, and a half a year. In Revelation, that's defined for us in terms of a 360-day year. And it appears that that's what the early calendars were, was a perfect 360-day year. The 360 degrees of a circle. And so you had this reality that was changed, and changed dramatically at the flood, with shortened lifespans. The flora and the fauna was changed. Geography was changed. And all of that was changed, and within a year. I mean, the flood was a year-long event, but it all happened within a year or two. All these changes began. The vapor canopy was taken out. Most likely, the decrease in longevity is due to increased radiation from the sun. One thing we certainly know about radiation: it never impacts an organism in a good way. All radiation is, by its very definition, harmful. And it always damages an organism or kills it, given enough radiation. And so you get enough. And you see the people, you go to your medical deal or your dentist and all of that, when they x-ray you, they don't stay in there. Because they know this is toxic. And so that's why, you know, I'm going to tell my dentist, he said, well, we want to do x-rays every year. No, you don't need x-rays every year, for one thing, unless you've got some sort of problems in your mouth, and you might need them if you have dental problems. I don't tend to have. So no, I'm not going to let you x-ray me every year just because you think I need to have it. And if you don't like it, I'll go find another dentist. You know, dentists grow on trees, frankly. You can find a dentist pretty readily. Now, he may not be good. Go to the dental school, let them practice on you. So again, here, things are going to change. And it appears that the world will be moved, physically moved. And that things are going to geographically change again. And certainly in terms of the year rotation speed of the earth and the length of time for a year. Will appear to go back to 360 days, not the 365 point whatever we got now, 25 or whatever it is. So again, this is a worldwide impact. The heavens will tremble. The earth will move from its place at the fury of the Lord of the armies in the day of his burning anger. And the reality is here, by the way, you're going to find a bunch of words that God's not just a little mad. God is furiously raging. He is going to scare the daylights out of everybody. And his anger, his wrath against sin is going to be manifested in an unrestrained fashion. He's been holding it back, so he's patient. He gives people time to orient. And that hatred of sin, though, continues to build and build and build and build and build, using the analogy that we would use as humans. Whereas for God, it's a matter of righteousness and justice, more than emotion. So we apply these human emotions to God, that he's angry. What can God do when he's angry? You don't want to know. Well, the enemy, so familiarity here, point 18, with the ancient nation of Babylon and the events that led to its demise, mandate that it cannot be the historical city nation in view in these passages. The enemy of prophetic Babylon comes from the far north. You can see these passages, Isaiah 13, 17, while we're there. I am going to stir up, as they're called, the Medes. against them. And of course, many want to identify this as the ancient Medes. Well, at verse 5 of Isaiah 13, if you back up there into that verse, it says they are coming from a far country, from the farthest horizons. In other words, they're coming from a long way off. They're not proximate to Babylon at all. And so, as we'll see these other ones, Jeremiah 53 and 9, I'm not going to look these up today because we're going to go over this multiple times. And Jeremiah 51:48, you can just look the passages up on your own to document, yes, these do say what he says. And the key one there, well, I'll just look up the Jeremiah 51 first here, 3. For a nation has come up against her out of the north. Now it says from the farthest horizons, and now it gives us a geographic notation. From the farthest north horizons. From as far away as you can get north. But north of where? Is it north of Babylon? Most scholars recognize that when directions are given in the Bible, they are given from Jerusalem. That Jerusalem is the center of God's, the focal point of God's plan. And that when he talks about the west, the word they used for west was yom. And that's the Hebrew word for sea. Why is the sea west? Because it's the Mediterranean. That's the west for them. And they would use far north, and the north meant dark regions. Regions that were comparatively, we might say, obscure for those living in Jerusalem or Israel. And the south, they use the word Negev. The Negev, the desert down there. You can see that on maps. It's still there. They still call it that, in fact. Some of them spell it with a V. Some of them spell it with a B or BH. Prophetic Babylon there comes from the far north. See those verses. While the enemies of historic Babylon did not come from the far north or from some distant horizon. They came from the immediate east and southeast. And you have... That's the ancient Babylon map. I probably sent it out to you. But here, the point of all this, you can pretty readily see it, I think. Here's the Babylonian kingdom, the extent of it in the orange there. And here's where Medo-Persia lied. Right here immediately to barely, you might say, to the north, but certainly not ways off. They were proximate. They were neighbors. And the Medo-Persians came from this area in here generally. And that's not way far north of Babylon at all. And it's certainly not distant horizons away. And that obviously the language of the Bible is much like we talk. We talk from the far horizon. Well, there's only one horizon, right? You can only see so far. And that's all you can see. So it should be understood that when the Bible provides directions, that they are determined in relation to the land of Israel or even specifically to Jerusalem. And certainly Medo-Persia is not north of Jerusalem at all. And again, it's very proximate to Babylon. It's not a long ways off. So you can't look to an historical fulfillment for this because Babylon's enemies came from right here next to them. And again, the destruction is not the same as we will see. So therefore, when the term Medes is used, it cannot be referring to the historic Medes since they would not qualify geographically. We saw Isaiah 13:17 there. We can look at Jeremiah 51. This is where you have to pay attention to the details in prophecy. When they give directions, okay, who are they talking about, from where, and all of that. Isaiah 51:11. Sharpen the arrows. Fill the quivers. That's another interesting thing. The destruction here is constantly talked of in bows and arrows. And typically, the archers never conquered a city by themselves. They couldn't. You had to have other ways and other forms and other weapons to conquer a city. It wasn't historically done with just archery. Fill the quivers. The Lord has aroused the spirit of the kings of the Medes. For his purpose is against Babylon to destroy it. For it is the vengeance of the Lord. A vengeance for his temple. The prophetic Medes from the far north must be identified as modern Russia. Which includes all the satellite, quote, nations. By the way, if you think all those nations are free and they aren't still recognizing that the Soviets could crush them in a heartbeat, you're wrong. They know that they are in the shadow of the bear. And they know they better not cross the bear. Putin will not put up with nonsense, as you have probably observed. And so it has to be identified as modern Russia, which includes all of those satellite nations that were formerly part of the Soviet Union, but which continue to exist in Russia's shadow. Jeremiah 51, 28. And so this is an alliance that comes against the United States. It isn't just Russia, but it's Russia and all her allies and satellites that she has. Consecrate the nations against her, the kings of the Medes, their governors and all their prefects, and every land of their dominion that they exercise sway over. And so if you look at that other map I sent out, the far north map, and again, if you want to take this from Jerusalem, there's right there, as you can probably see, due north of Jerusalem lies Moscow, which is the capital, as you may know, of Russia. And if you even go due north from Iraq here, where's Baghdad? Right there is about where Babylon was. It's not far from Baghdad. You're still into Russia. This is the end of the horizons. Up here, there's nothing more. It's just all wasteland. As you know, as you get up towards the Arctic Circle. And so you can figure in here Vilnius, Belarus, Ukraine, Georgia down here, Azerbaijan, Armenia. There's indications that Turkey may be involved in this. We don't know for certain. But all that is Kazakhstan, all of these people that they still control. Any of them that don't want to, quote, fight with Russia, will cooperate with Russia. And if you live right there on Russia's doorstep, you damn well better cooperate. Because you're going to regret it if you don't. And this is going to be, again, so organized that it's not even funny. But here you go, right out of Israel, you go due north, the farthest extent to the north, the last nation you have up there is Russia, essentially. And then you get into the wasteland. So E, while a complete destruction is decreed for commercial Babylon, you see these verses, it's going to be total. There's not going to be any survivors. Isaiah 13, 5 through 9. Jeremiah 50, 26, 32, 51, 2, and 11. The Medes and the Persians did not destroy Babylon, but conquered it and left it intact. And so when you consider Daniel and how this all happened historically, you have to say, well, then these verses can't... And yet, I still watch, and still today, almost all modern scholarship looks to historic Babylon and tries to place this in the 500s, 600s, or 700s B.C., this destruction. But when you consider, how was Babylon destroyed? Well, Daniel 5:31. And here's Belshazzar, who's a degenerate moron. He's now the leader of the Babylonian Empire. And his leadership won't last long. And they violated, he tasted the wine in verse 2. He gave orders to bring the gold and silver vessels, which Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, so that the kings, his nobles, his wives, and his chippies could drink from them. That's what concubines are, they're chippies. So it's a modern vernacular, so you know. Whores, that you know, just they're not wives. They're just people he keeps on the side. Concubines maybe sounds better. But it's not. And so you get down here to the end of all of this. And of course, this is the famous handwriting on the wall scene. This is where we get that expression, handwriting on the wall. What's the handwriting on the wall? It means your days are over. It means your time has come. And so this hand appears out of nowhere. The hand was sent from God, it says. And the message was this, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. And this is the interpretation of the message. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. It's repeated twice to emphasize the totality of that and the surety of that. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found deficient. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persian. And then Belshazzar gave orders and they clothed Daniel with purple. That's always good with the outgoing king. Get a big promotion. Whoops. But he maintained his position here. God took care of him. Or care of him. And in verse 30, that same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean Mede king, was slain. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at the age of 62. And that all sounds fine and good. And when you go in and you do, Darius just sets up the kingdom. The kingdom remains intact. Babylon is not destroyed. And in fact, they were having, it was a festival season for some reason, if I remember, one of their gods, I think. And they were all, a lot of them were partying in a festival, and they didn't even know the kingdom had been taken until weeks later. Some of them didn't find out till months later. And so there was no big slaughter. There was no loss, a significant loss of life. Now, when the Medes and Persians came in, they went in, took the royal family, killed all them. But the kingdom remained intact. And the Medes and Persians just moved in and took over. And in fact, because Belshazzar there was not a particularly popular guy, many of the Babylonians welcomed Cyrus as a conqueror, a hailing conqueror. A king, a wonderful king, they thought. And he was going to take over for them. Or Darius here, who actually ends up receiving the kingdom, as we'll see. So, again, they walked in, they left the kingdom intact, the nation wasn't destroyed, there was no physical damage. They had tried besieging Babylon, and they saw that it would not work. They knew they could never conquer it. Until they came up with the brilliant idea of the river that fed their water supply that flowed under the walls could be dammed upstream. And you could just walk in. And that's how they did it. And so they walked in, went right to the royal palace, killed all them. Daniel was there and he survived. So they were not indiscriminately killing people when they conquered Babylon. There was, in fact, no significant loss of life that can be pointed at here. So why they want to keep making this that destruction is just beyond. And yet, and time and time again, I'll see, well, they say, well, there's actually a problem here. There's a contradiction because this doesn't fit. And they'll keep saying it, and then they keep advancing the same theory that they've already admitted doesn't fit. Well, F, the city continued to enjoy prosperity under the Medo-Persians and became the headquarters for Alexander the Great in about 330 BC. Does that sound like it's remained uninhabited? No. Because the fall of Babylon occurred under Darius there back in the 500s BC. So, G, during the subsequent wars among Alexander's generals, Babylon came under the power of Seleucus, who was prompted by ambition to build a capital for himself and founded Seleucia near Babylon in about 293 BC. And H, this rival city gradually drew away many of the inhabitants of Babylon. Strabo, he's a Roman historian, recorded the fact that Babylon was largely deserted during the time of Tiberius, who ruled from 14 to 37 AD. And then economic commercial Babylon is to be destroyed in a sudden fiery judgment like Sodom and Gomorrah. Historic Babylon did not fall to this type of cataclysm, but was just gradually abandoned. So that doesn't fit the prophecy. This is not a talking about a gradual, well, I'm going to draw the people off and the city will eventually fade into ruin. It's I'm going to destroy it all in a day. And Babylon, ancient Babylon, was captured in a day. But again, with no significant loss of life. No significant people were killed. No numbers. But it was just gradually abandoned. And these are passages, all of them, that will deal with this in terms of Sodom and Gomorrah. That destruction, how fast did that happen? How many survived it that were in Sodom and Gomorrah? And the answer is none. Verse 8 here of Revelation 8, you can see these other verses, Isaiah 13, 19, Jeremiah 50, verse 40, Revelation 18, 8, for this reason in one day her plagues will come. Now, again, plagues, pestilence and mourning and famine, that never happened in historic Babylon at all. In fact, they could have ridden out a siege for months, if not years. And that's why the Persians, the Medo-Persians, knew they couldn't conquer that city until they came up with this genius idea to go under the walls. And so you can see there, verse 8 and then 10, standing at a great distance because of the fear of the torment she has received. Saying, woe, woe, the great city, Babylon, the strong city, in one hour as your judgment come. And so you have to ask yourself, and we'll get to this verse, is one hour literal? Or is this just for some indefinite period of time? We'll deal with that. Well, J, commercial Babylon will never again be inhabited. See Isaiah 13, 20, Jeremiah 50, 13, and 39. And again, I'm not stopping to read all these because we're going to get through these. But historic Babylon has been inhabited at various times through the centuries. In 917 AD, Ad-Ibu Handel mentions Babylon as a small village. By 1100 AD, it had grown into a town with two mosques. In 1898, it had 10,000 inhabitants. Today, it lies within the modern town of Hillel, boasting a population of about 85,000. Does that sound uninhabited to you? I mean, even the ruins of the ancient city, people go there all the time. Archaeologists love it, of course. But people go there just to see the sites. If you want to take a trip to Iraq, go. No, I wouldn't. I don't think it's wise for Americans to be out of this country, frankly, given the climate out there and the anti-American sentiment that's getting to be almost everywhere. And I even got insulted the other day. I was playing online poker and some guy insulted me, calling me a Trumpite. You know, I was like, wow. I don't know. So when economic Babylon is destroyed, no part of it will ever be used to build another city. Jeremiah 51:26, that one we do need to look at because that one's really critical to this. Jeremiah 51, again, we'll get to see all these in time. This will be a fun chapter. It's only 64 verses long. I'll get through that in a couple of classes probably. Nothing to it. After I did Romans, I could do anything. As it says here, behold, I am against you, O destroying mountain, verse 25, who destroys the whole earth, declares the Lord. And I will stretch out my hand against you and roll you down from the crags. And I will make you a burnt out mountain. They will not even take for you even a stone for a corner, nor a stone for foundations, but you will be desolate forever, declares the Lord. But here, many building materials from the ruins of historic Babylon have been used in the construction of other cities, which include Seleucia, Ctesiphon, Almaden, Kufa, Hillel, and Baghdad. Oh, by the way, Baghdad is composed. They've taken bricks. See, Hussein wanted, he was going to be, in his mind, a latter-day Nebuchadnezzar. And he took stuff from Babylon, and he wanted to restore all the ruins, in fact, and restore it to its glory. It didn't work out for him. But they took things from this in the building of Baghdad and used it. Well, that violates the prophecy here. You can't take anything. Nothing from here will be used ever again to build. Well, and the big reason, of course, is radiation. Nobody wants to go, let's go mine some radioactive bricks. There's a lot of bricks in America now. Yeah, do you want them? Well, the Encyclopedia of Lands and Peoples, Volume 3, published by Grolier, states of Babylon, they found great treasure, and the materials of its wonderful buildings were used for the construction of Baghdad in 726 A.D. Well, that violates this prophecy all over the place. If that's the fulfillment, it was historic Babylon. It's not. And the command to physically separate from Babylon is followed by a negative purpose clause that introduces two reasons here for the commanded exodus. Come out of her, my people, lest you participate in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues. B or 20 here, Alan has correctly noted that there is a chiasm in the usual Greek word order that is recorded in an A-B-B-A pattern, with the second prepositional phrase placed before the second hina, so that or in order that. And 21, this is designed to heighten the connection between the two clauses and seems to suggest a cause and effect relationship. The reason he wants them to come out is so they don't participate in their sins, and the result of that will be receiving of her plagues. So there is a cause and effect relationship here. If you're going to participate with Babylon, you're going to suffer with her as well. You're going to suffer the penalty for doing so. And so 22, the first reason for geographic separation is to avoid participating in the sins that characterize Babylon. What are those sins? Which include arrogance, conspicuous consumption, and a self-centered disregard for others. That sums up your average American today. And that's sad. As believers, that's not the lifestyle we're called to live. We're not called to live to keep the poor things going lest the economy tank and we all get screwed, as Chuck Lorre said. It's not why we're called. This constant deal of buying and got to have more and all of that, that is not the mentality of an adjusted believer. Adjusted believers learn that that's a dead-end street, for one thing. And given what goes on here, is part of the cause of the ruin of this nation. And your average Babylonian, this is what they do. They're arrogant. They are designed for commercial consumption. And they want to just buy and buy and buy and buy and buy. Money and buying and all of this. And that's it. So shopping becomes a exercise. It's not an exercise. Some people might think it is, but it's not. Well, these examples include the manifestation of arrogance. Isaiah 47, 7 and 8. Jeremiah 50, 31 and 32. A false sense of security. Let's look at some of these Isaiah 47. Those are passages we haven't really kind of looked at yet. But again, we're going to cover the entire chapter at some point in this. Jeremiah, arrogance, 7 and 8. Yet you said, I will be a queen forever. America will always come back. Will it? No. That's false doctrine. Human viewpoint. The Bible says it's not. And yet, this is the arrogance of this country. We believe we're invincible. Because why? We've never been militarily defeated on our own shores. We've never been attacked here in the contiguous 48. And really haven't been attacked in Alaska and Hawaii either, even though they're not contiguous. But we haven't suffered any of that. But these things you did not consider, nor did you remember the outcome of them. Now then, hear this, you sensual one who dwells securely, who says in your heart, I am and there is no one besides me. I will not sit as a widow, nor know the loss of children. And then Jeremiah 50. They also have a false sense of security. Verse 10. You felt secure in your wickedness. And you said, no one sees me. See, the American leadership behind the scenes think they're getting away with this. If I, a high school graduate, and just a student of the Bible, I'm smart enough to figure out what's going on, why can't anybody else? And the reality is people could figure out what's going on. They don't want to. This is not popular teaching, as you might imagine. So you said, no one sees me. Your wisdom and your knowledge have deluded you. And so the average American here lives in a state of delusion. That everything's fine. That it's all going to continue just as it is. And people believe this, and so they're not worried about it. So they never make any changes in their lifestyle. Why should they? They're complacent. And then, you know, one of the verses in Proverbs, I said, the complacency of fools will destroy them. And that's what's going to happen here. This nation is so complacent. And I looked at it yesterday. I watched all these games being played in the rain, many of them in the cold rain. 30-degree temperatures and all of that. I see them sitting out there huddled up in their little slickers and their raincoats and their hats and all this so they could stay warm. And I thought, you can get 60,000 morons out on a Saturday to do this. And if I had 60 people in Bible class, I'd faint. Why? Because Americans are consumed with all the wrong things. Don't get me wrong, I love football. Particularly college football. I don't like the pro game that much. But particularly college football. But, you know, and I looked at this and I think, where are the priorities? How many people attended football games yesterday? Now, it's not as popular here because, you know, I saw the game where South Florida was playing up there. And that stadium was a ghost town. I mean, if there had 10,000 people there, it's probably lucky. You know, it was Raymond James, so they're used to having, you know, they were filling it up for the Bucks. And I thought to myself, well, they're not interested in this. And of course, their undefeated season came to a crashing end yesterday. So, as several teams did. So, I like football, don't get me wrong. I like entertainment, don't get me wrong. I don't sit at home just with my nose in the Bible all the time. Maybe you think I'm boring. I like music. I like golfing. I don't golf as much as I'd like to, but I like the game because you're just playing against yourself. The golf is a game played up here. Right there. And so, but I don't get out and do it as much as I'd like. But you know, I look at this and people, I guarantee you, well over a million people, probably 10 million people attended football games yesterday. How many of them are in a Bible class today? Well, they're worshiping God out on the golf course. That's why. Or wherever they are. And the vast majority of them won't darken a church to save their souls. Literally, to save their souls. They wouldn't do it. And I look at this and I just think, wow, what an indictment of our country. Here's the truth. Being taught at a high level. If I didn't think I was doing it at a high level, I'd quit. I would tell you, get another pastor. I'm not doing this right. I'm not into it. If I ever get tired of it and want to quit, I'll let you know. I mean, don't get me wrong, I've been tempted. But as a general rule, no, I'm not. Because what else are you going to do? I'm going to go live like another Babylonian? Let's go to the mall. Let's go to the football game. Let's go eat. And again, I'm not against eating, football, or the mall. I'm not against any of those things. It's just the preoccupation with these things that takes the place of application of Bible doctrine. That's what I'm against. So, again, a false sense of security, embracing the homosexual menace as seen in the persistent references to Sodom and Gomorrah. You can see Isaiah 13, 19, Jeremiah 49, 18, and 50, 40. Anti-Semitism is constantly referenced here. We haven't treated the Jews right. Our nation has, again, in many cases, been very duplicitous with the Jews. We give them our support and all, and tell them this, and then we arm their enemies. That's wrong. Well, that's absolutely wrong. Part of being a friend with Israel is you've got to withstand their enemies against them. But that's not popular, because we're supposed to be open-minded and say, everybody's got a right to that land, like hell they do. They don't. That land was given to Abraham and his descendants. And the Palestinians aren't a part of that. They came through, if they came through at all, they came through the line of Ishmael. And that line was written out of the covenant. And I didn't do it, God did. So if people don't like it, take it up with God. Tell him he doesn't have the right to give his earth to who he wants. And see how far you get with that. Because God's not going to put up with it. This is all his by virtue of creation. He can give it to whoever he wants. And that land is Israel's. And it's going to stay Israel's forever. And it's going to be greatly broadened. How far exactly, we don't really know. But another reason, and that's another subtle thing I wanted to point out here. When you look at the historic size of Israel. Come on, what are you doing? Yeah, I'll close that then. Let's try it again. There, all right, there you go. Here's Israel, little bitty Israel. Here. And... But if you read the Abrahamic covenant back in, I think it's, and this actually was just a reiteration of the covenant. Genesis, I believe it's during that vision, Genesis 15, I think. Yeah, Genesis 15, verse 18. That's it. On that day, the Lord made an agreement, a covenant with Abraham. Signed a contract, we might say. So is this binding? Well, yes. Just as if you sign a contract, it's binding. You better read the small print. He said, to your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. Now, when you look at this picture, they've got the river of Egypt as the Nile, which I don't think it is. I think it's actually over here. I think it's actually a wadi they're referring to. But even if it's right here, somewhere on the Sinai Peninsula, and then over to the great river Euphrates over here. That's considerably bigger than what they occupy now. And so also, by the way, if this is to be the extent of their land, would it make any sense for this to be a nuclear radioactive waste here? That you couldn't even approach? Mm-mm. So you have to rule out modern Iraq. You have to rule out ancient Baghdad, or Babylon rather. You have to rule out ancient Babylon. You have to rule out modern Babylon. Because if this is where Israel is going to be living in these borders. Now this I think is a little extreme. I'll grant you that. I don't think it necessarily means they get all this. But even if they just live over to the Euphrates, and it's up here in the north, I don't care. That's still very proximate to where Baghdad or Babylon is. Keep thinking of the modern capital, but Babylon, that's where Babylon is. So that can't be a nuclear active, radioactive waste that no one would approach. Now, there's going to be people living there. There's no doubt about that. So again, anti-Semitism. They're accused of materialism. We saw that in Revelation 18:3, and internationalism. Again, the idea that money makes people happy. The details will satisfy the soul. They won't. I don't care how many of them you get. And the more details you get, the more work you got to do to take care of them. I mean, you know, I've noticed this. Details don't take care of themselves. My lawnmower doesn't do its own maintenance. You know. So if there's work has to be done in my house, the house doesn't fix itself. You know, I have to do it or it doesn't get done. So all of these things, these charges against this country, and it's not just a single charge, it's a litany of charges. And serious charges at that, serious crimes against humanity. 24, history has determined that the U.S. has not only become guilty of violating vast portions of the Word of God, but also encouraging and approving those that promote behaviors and lifestyles and are gross manifestations of the old sin nature. Romans, we saw that at the end there of chapter 1 in the indictment of the Gentile peoples. Although they know the ordinance of God, the law of God about this stuff, they know it. That those who practice such things are worthy of death. They not only do the same things, but they give hearty approval to those who practice them. So we're not chiding the materialist. We congratulate them. We're not saying you are wrong and need to clean up your act. We're telling them you're great. Same thing with the homosexuals. Same thing with the anti-family people. Same thing with internationalism. We're not sticking to our national boundaries and doing what we're supposed to do. We're meddling all over the globe. And God help us, because we've been warned. And it's all in the Bible and spelled out. And what are people going to do about it? Well, we'll see. Well, 25, as Keithley points out, the sins of her point to particular and specific sins. The sins of commercialism. The things which caused universal covetousness. Destruction of the divine institutions. Increase in crime, violence, and the search for happiness in luxurious living. If I can just get a bigger house, more details, a better car, I'll be happy. And then what will you want? A bigger house, a bigger car, more details. You're not happy. That's the problem. And when people aren't happy with what they have, well, that's a complete violation of phase 2 doctrine for the believer. Be content with such things as you have. Quit buying more. Simply because you can. Use your money for something that's maybe helpful, rather than just feeding your own consumer lust. That's. And again, we're not against people having things or buying things or God providing things. But the fact is, this country's got it way out of balance. Way out of balance. To argue for people to quit doing this, that you don't need 50 watches. You don't need 150 suits. You don't need 85 pairs of slacks. You know, in men's slacks, do you know how many colors they make? 4 or 5. I mean, unless you want to wear golf pants. Come in here dressed like John Daly. Drunker in a hoot owl, you know. No, I'm kidding. I wouldn't do that, but I don't dress that way. You see, and maybe it's an old man affliction. I don't know. But you see, as they get older, men start wearing these more flamboyant clothes. And I just think, what is wrong with you? Or you'll tell somebody, well, a lot of people can't pull that off, but it looks good on you. Sure, turquoise is a great color for you. Men's slacks. Well, they don't make turquoise slacks, unless you're a golfer. You know, they'll wear them. And I watch some of them guys, and I think, if you're young enough, you should know better. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't dress this way. But yeah, that's their taste, I guess. Well, 26, the verb John uses is soon koinoneo, to share in common with someone, is one that denotes an intimate sharing in something, with the nuance of becoming a partner in that enterprise. And so when he says here in verse 4, that you may not participate in her sins. The implication is they are. That they're sharing in this in a very close level. Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians 5:11. Just a general sense here, believers, do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness. But instead, even expose them. Point out that believers that are out here spending money hand over fist are idiots. And that they need to know, they need to stop it, knock it off. That this isn't God's will for your life. To be another foolish Babylonian. This isn't what God wants for His children. His children are to let their light shine. They're to see. They're set an example. They're to be different. Conspicuously different. Now, we're not to go out and just intentionally be weird to draw attention to ourselves. That's not what we're talking about. But today, you just don't shop and you're weird. You know, you just avoid all the rigmarole and the money go round. And that's it. Always grabbing for the brass ring and never getting it. But keep trying. You'll win next time. That's the motto of the lottery. Don't give up. Don't do math either. Because you'll figure out you should give up. Philippians 4:14 also. Here Paul talks about the fact that these people entered into his sufferings. They were concerned with him. They weren't just wrapped up in their own little deal. And Philippi was a fairly prosperous place. It was not a small little deal. This was the home of a lot of retired Romans, in fact. So you have done well to share with me in my affliction. And Paul talks about his afflictions regularly. How sometimes he doesn't have enough. Well, that's a shame for the believers that are under his authority. They should have made sure their spiritual authority had enough. That's an indictment of them. So, but they probably had important stuff they needed to buy. You know, they needed that new flat screen. They needed the new, shall we call it, something new that came out, like a Walkman. And, oh yeah, you remember all the things, you know, I remember it was kind of funny because I was watching an old episode of the Goldbergs. I say old, it was from the first season, I think. And they were talking about, you know, you had this entire album collection, and then suddenly when CDs came out, it was just useless. No, cassettes came out first. Then you didn't use your albums anymore, you had all these cassettes. Then you had all the cassettes became CDs. And you knew that, you know, so you keep buying this same music over and over again, just in a different form. And so people aren't content with what they got. They got to have the newest, latest form of it. Now it's MP3s. You can get it. You don't even have to have a player speak up. You can play it through your stereo if you want. So the second clause here makes it certain. Makes it certain that those that continue to remain in Babylon and participate or fellowship in her sins will fall under God's justice and share or fellowship in her punishment. And interpreters have noted a couple of parallels that include Lot and Sodom. Certainly that's parallel to this because you have a rich, prosperous place, the economy, it was the sort of the apple of their eye at that day. It was the pinnacle of economic commercialism during that period, in that time. And his notorious wife, who identified herself with the cities of the damned. They were warned to get out. Obviously, there's a great parallel here. Number one, they're told ahead of time it's coming. Number two, they're given plenty of time to respond. And then finally, he's told when the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away in the punishment of the city." But he hesitated. All my friends are here. All my money's here. My investments are here. Oh, too bad. So the men seized his hand and the hand of his wife and his two daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was on him. And they brought him out and put him outside the city. And there also verse 17. And when they had brought him outside, one said, "Escape for your life. Do not look behind you and do not stay anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains or you will be swept away." And then Lot proceeds to argue with the angels. While they're saving him, he's arguing with them that he needs to go back. Now, why did they have to get out of the valley? Because what happened, apparently, was there were a lot of explosive gases released. And when a lot of explosive gases were released, all it took was a single spark. And when God began to rain fire down from heaven, that whole area became an inferno. I mean, it became a holocaust. A blazing furnace that destroyed everything in that valley. And obviously, as you get up towards the mountaintops where the wind is and all of that, there comes a cap to it where it couldn't get any higher. But everybody in the valley died. All of them. And God killed, as we saw in the flood, how many? And there had been a population explosion before the flood. So he killed millions and millions of people in the flood, no doubt. And he killed quite a few people here in Sodom and Gomorrah. God has shown that I will wipe out whole segments of the civilization and not bat an eye while doing it. So for people to think, well, he wouldn't do that to this country. He's told you repeatedly that this parallels Sodom and Gomorrah. And you better listen. It's going to happen. And so 1926, of course, we get, he overthrew all those cities, all the valley and all the inhabitants and what grew on the ground. And his wife from behind him looked back and she became a pillar of salt. And that was God's judgment on her. Just turned her into salt right there. But salt's all that's left over there. That's why the Dead Sea is so salty. Sodom and Gomorrah were situated, it's probably underwater now, but were situated in the lower part there. And that whole area was turned into a salt flat. That's all that's left. And so the Dead Sea, I've heard about it. It'd be interesting to go over there. I would want to go necessarily, but I'd like to float in it because it's so salty that you're so much more buoyant. I think it would be interesting just to see. The human body is so much more buoyant there. Okay, well, our time is gone. We'll stop there with the turning you into salt if you continue to do this. As a Babylonian, you better listen and pay attention. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to consider these matters. We pray that you would sanctify this to our souls, that we implicate these things into our lives and obey the commands that are incumbent upon us as positive believers. For we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.